The president calls for political peace with the Democrats. The Intelligence Committee declares war on the FBI. And the House, well, it's up for grabs. It already feels like November on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Trump says the State of the Union is strong, but not a word about the issue consuming his presidency, Russia.
It's not the least bit surprising that he didn't mention it. I mean, he really was trying to kind of set a different tone. And you know that it would have stuck out like a sore thumb in the midst of the victory lap over the tax cut and the let's be bipartisan.
Plus, Republicans have an advantage in the House thanks to favorable district lines and money. But is that enough to stop a potential Democratic wave in November?
The short answer is no. I think history tells us that midterm elections are terrible for the president's party. So actually, the quickest way for Democrats to regain the House was actually to lose the 2016 presidential race.
And hey, did you hear the one about Ted Kennedy and the Florida billboard?
A young 22-year-old came down to open up a headquarters for Kennedy in Palm Beach County and never realized that above was a sign from a previous owner that said, learn to drive. So here he has a Kennedy headquarters, you know, after Chappaquiddick would learn to drive, and he was devastated by it.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, because they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 214 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. While President Trump spent Tuesday evening urging Americans to set aside our differences and put politics aside, Republicans on Capitol Hill were doing what they've been doing for quite some time, following the president's line and casting doubt on the FBI and others who were investigating the possibility of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Under the leadership of California Republican Devin Nunes, the House Intelligence Committee voted to release a memo that accused the Justice Department and the FBI of overstepping their authority by getting a secret surveillance order against a Trump campaign aide. This vote came despite the Justice Department's warning that the release of the memo, which was assembled by a top Nunes staffer, would be, quote, extraordinarily reckless. The FBI joined in the criticism on Wednesday. Nunes and company took the vote to bolster their argument that the FBI was guilty of political bias, both in its investigation of Trump and its handling of Hillary Clinton and her emails. For Adam Schiff, the ranking Democrat on the committee, it was a shameful decision that put politics ahead of national security.
This committee voted to put the president's personal interest, perhaps their own political interest, above the national interest, in denying themselves even the ability to hear from the department and the FBI. But it does show how, in my view, when you have a deeply flawed person in the Oval Office, that flaw can infect the whole of government. And today, tragically, it infected our committee.
The memo is now in the hands of the president, who will review it and decide whether or not to have it released. Democratic efforts to have the committee also release their contrary findings were rejected by the Republican majority. Democrats say this is all part of a combined White House GOP effort to discredit Special Counsel Robert Mueller and the FBI, which is investigating possible collusion.
I can only say this, there was absolutely no collusion. Everybody knows it.
Between the Trump campaign and Russia. One other Trump target has been Andrew McCabe, the deputy director of the FBI. The firing of James Comey by the president last May elevated McCabe's role in investigating Trump. He also played a role in the investigation of Hillary Clinton's emails in 2016. But Republicans, led by Trump, have insisted that McCabe should have recused himself from the case because his wife, when she ran for the Virginia State Senate in 2015, took $500,000 from a group associated with Governor Terry McAuliffe, a longtime Clinton ally. But that election came months before McCabe became deputy director. Still, it was too much for Trump, who ranted about it during the campaign.
The man who was in charge of the investigation of Hillary Clinton accepted, essentially, from Hillary Clinton, $675,000 that went to his wife. Never happened before. Never happened. Not in this country's history. This is a disgrace.
But questions about how the FBI dealt with the Hillary email issue remain. And an upcoming report from the Justice Department's Inspector General is expected to be critical of McCabe's role during the investigation. Meanwhile, Democrats and some Republicans continue to be concerned about Robert Mueller's future as special counsel. The New York Times reported last week that Trump tried to have Mueller fired last June, but backed down when the White House counsel, Donald McGahn, said he would quit if that happened. That led to a bipartisan congressional effort to protect Mueller's job. But that has been swatted away by House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who said it's not needed at this time. Not everyone agrees. Here was South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, a member of the Judiciary Committee, on ABC's This Week.
Mueller's doing a good job. I have confidence in him to get to the bottom of all things Russia. And Don McGahn, if the story is true in the New York Times, did the right thing. And the good news is the president listened. I'm sure that there'll be an investigation around whether or not President Trump did try to fire Mr. Mueller. We know that he didn't fire Mr. Mueller. We know that if he tried to, it'd be the end of his presidency.
So, a quick summation. McCabe is leaving, and Mueller is staying, at least for now. And President Oprah Winfrey? Not happening. Here's the report from Inside Edition.
She's not running for president. That's the word from Oprah in InStyle magazine's new cover story. It's not something that interests me. I don't have the DNA for it. That's not for me.
And that somehow leads to this week's trivia question. What African-American female presidential candidate received the most votes in a general election? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
She had a tragic fascination.
So let's begin tonight by recognizing that the state of our union is strong because our people are strong.
Tuesday night, President Trump gave his first State of the Union message before a joint session of Congress. The speech lasted an hour and 20 minutes, the third longest in history, and it was notable for what he said and what he didn't. He called for the two parties to put politics aside and spoke of compromise, but showed no willingness to give on its core issues. He movingly spoke of victims of gun violence, but nothing about the scourge of guns. He took credit for the rising economy and talked about the greatest tax cuts in history, which kind of stretched the facts. He lauded the concept of clean coal, but nary a word about clean air or clean water. And speaking of what wasn't mentioned, there was no reference at all to Russia. But maybe that wasn't much of a surprise. Janet Hook is a political reporter with the Wall Street Journal and watched the speech Tuesday night like the rest of us and lived to tell the tale. Janet, it's great having you back again on The Political Junkie.
Always great to talk to you.
Well, you know, the history of these State of the Union addresses, it never seems to change. We talk about them to death in advance and not long after they're finished, they get completely forgotten. So I guess my question is, was there anything in the speech that sounded memorable, that's something that would last?
Well, I thought the thing that was most remarkable about this particular speech, the short answer to your question is I don't think much of it was remarkable or memorable. But what was remarkable was how different it was in tone from Trump's inaugural address a year ago. I mean, this was like a far cry from the vision of America that he presented from the steps of the Capitol when he saw American carnage and rusted out factories. That doesn't sound like a nation that he regarded as particularly strong. And it was a very kind of dark image. And now he comes and after a year of Trump, we have a new American moment. I mean, it is true with Trump in general, and it's not just in these big speeches, but with these big speeches, you never know what Donald Trump is going to show up at the podium. And Tuesday night, the Donald Trump who showed up was more optimistic than what we saw when he was first sworn in, and much more scripted than he usually is.
Over the last year, the world has seen what we always knew, that no people on earth are so fearless or daring or determined as Americans. If there is a mountain, we climb it. If there's a frontier, we cross it. If there's a challenge, we tame it. If there's an opportunity, we seize it.
Janet, you're absolutely right. I mean, that sounds like a complete 180 from the despair we heard during his inaugural address.
Yes, it's almost Kennedy-esque. I mean, there's just this sense of grandeur and sweep that he is presenting. And he also grabbed onto the tradition that presidents have had for decades now of putting some American heroes in the audience and paying homage to them. And those were among the few bipartisan moments of the speech when they recognize acts of heroism. So this was a speech that if you dropped in at any particular moment, you would hardly recognize this as the same president who sends out the kinds of tweets that he does and throws out sort of divisive, provocative rhetoric in almost every other public appearance.
You know, other people have pointed out the fact that, you know, last year when he spoke to a joint session of Congress, which was, of course, not a State of the Union, but he also was very statesmanlike in that speech before the joint session. And then 4 days later, he was tweeting that, you know, President Obama's illegally had me under surveillance. So those good moments don't last that long. But I want to play what, to me, impressed me the most from Tuesday night's speech.
There has never been a better time to start living the American dream. So to every citizen watching at home tonight, no matter where you've been or where you've come from, this is your time. If you work hard, if you believe in yourself, if you believe in America, then you can dream anything. You can be anything. And together, we can achieve absolutely anything.
Janet, I never thought of it as Kennedy-esque, but it did feel a little Kennedy-esque, at least in that passage.
Right. I mean, he had passages like that where he was aspirational and optimistic. But then there were other parts of the speech that were much more reminiscent of his more divisive presidency, which is that so he talks about wanting to compromise and work together. But then when he talks about immigration, he made no gesture away from the bargaining position he's laid out, which Democrats find completely unacceptable. He didn't come out of the speech any closer to building a bridge substantively on any issue. He spoke in very general terms once again about infrastructure. And I think, if anything, the things that he said about immigration would make it harder, not easier, to reach an agreement with Democrats.
He also talked a lot of things about rising wages and tax, the greatest tax cuts in history. I read somewhere that a lot of fact checkers were working overtime Tuesday night because they were a lot of things that didn't happen to be true.
Right. Trump is very prone to superlatives when it comes to his own accomplishments, and he does tend to overstate the economic impact. In fact, I think by many measures, the economy is, yes, it's stronger than it once was, but not necessarily that much stronger than when Obama was in toward the end of his second term. I do think that the message is having an impact. In the latest Wall Street Journal poll, we found that people's satisfaction with the economy is way up. And I think it's both because, you know, there are more jobs and wages are going up some. But also, I do think that Trump is quite a cheerleader for the economy in a way that maybe Obama was not.
At the same time, though, in fairness to Trump, I think we both agree that if the economy were falling, we'd be blaming him. So maybe it was okay that he took this victory lap on Tuesday to talk about the, you know everything that's going well and the rise in the Dow and, unemployment numbers are down. So whether he's responsible or not, whether he happened to be here at the right time, I guess my point is that we would have criticized him, and rightly so, if the economy were sinking. So maybe he deserves some credit at least.
Well, I think probably the honest point that you're making is that presidents get more blame and more credit for the state of the economy. It's really be driven by lots and lots of forces, including the policies of the preceding president.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that also stood out to me is his talk about bipartisanship. I mean, I thought there was an irony to that because we've seen that he can, you know, be all smiles and talk about working together across party lines and then savage the people he's hoping to work deals with. But at one point he was talking about the shooting of Congressman Steve Scalise, which was emotional and everything. And Scalise got, of course, a standing ovation. But then the president said this.
In the aftermath of that terrible shooting, we came together, not as Republicans or Democrats, but as representatives of the people. But it is not enough to come together only in times of tragedy. Tonight, I call upon all of us to set aside our differences, to seek out common ground, and to summon the unity we need to deliver for the people.
I mean, that sounds beautiful, but it's almost like he was a completely different person. You almost ignore what's happened for the past year. And you also have a deadline coming up. You know, we're a week away from another potential logjam over spending, and that so-called call out for bipartisanship could disappear in a heartbeat.
Right. I mean, if eye rolling could shout, it would have been very noisy on the Democratic side of the aisle when he was calling for bipartisanship, because he really has proven to be singularly ineffective at connecting with Democrats or showing any effort to compromise that they consider credible.
You know, we kept talking about, you know, what he didn't say, and he didn't mention anything about Russia and the Russia investigation hanging over his administration. And I want to go back, because I'm obsessed with this, but I want to go back to Richard Nixon in his 1974 State of the Union address. Let me play a clip here.
I would like to add a personal word with regard to an issue that has been of great concern to all Americans over the past year. I refer, of course, to the investigations of the so-called Watergate affair. As you know, I have provided to the special prosecutor voluntarily a great deal of material. I believe that I have provided all the material that he needs to conclude his investigations and to proceed to prosecute the guilty and to clear the innocent. I believe the time has come to bring that investigation and the other investigations of this matter to an end. 1 year of Watergate is enough.
And then he sounded defiant.
And I want you to know that I have no intention whatever of ever walking away from the job that the people elected me to do for the people of the United States.
The fact is, Janet, of course, he did walk away 6 months later. Were you surprised that Trump didn't mention Russia or the witch hunt or his previous, you know, his earlier criticisms of the investigation?
Actually, when you see the rest of the speech, it's not the least bit surprising that he didn't mention it. I mean, he really was trying to kind of set a different tone and focus on the accomplishments of his first year. And you know that it would have stuck out like a sore thumb in the midst of the victory lap over the tax cut and the let's be bipartisan. If he had said anything about Russia, it just would have been completely out of character with the rest of the speech. Now, the fact that he chose to make this speech rather than one that would address those issues suggests a kind of a strategic focus that sometimes you can't count on him to achieve.
And what do you make of him leading his own applause? I was wondering if after all that clapping, his hands may be too sore to tweet.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, he hasn't tweeted for hours now. Who knows what happened there? Yeah, that was pretty funny. You know, sometimes you see athletes doing that, like they applauding themselves almost as an act of humility, like I'm joining you in celebrating something that isn't really me. But I've never seen a politician applaud for himself before.
What's your, so in the end, what is your takeaway? I mean, I mean, you know, I wrote on social media that if one pundit, one analyst says that he sounded very presidential, I was going to kick my foot through the TV set because I just can't stand, you know, deciding that he's presidential for one day because he could read a teleprompter for an hour and plus. But I thought it was a good speech. I thought it was, as you said, an optimistic speech. And it almost gave you hope until you realize who we're talking about.
Yeah, I would say you have a much more optimistic view of it than I did, because it really does feel like a speech that vanishes into thin air as soon as it's been spoken. And it may be that that's true of all politicians' speeches, but with Trump in particular, you know, the way he is today is so rarely a prediction of the way he's going to be tomorrow that I'm not so sure I would put this one down as a speech for the ages.
Janet Hook is a political reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She can be found on Twitter at HookJan. Janet, thanks as always for your insight.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now I don't know where I'm going. All I know to do is hit the ground running.
It's always fashionable to say that this year's midterm elections will be the most consequential ever. We seem to say that all the time, but in truth, midterm elections are the best way to see how voters feel about who's in the White House. Sometimes their verdict can be deadly. After 2 years of Ronald Reagan, the Republican loss in 1982 was 26 seats. With Bill Clinton in the White House, the damage to the Democrats in 1994 was 52 seats. And with it came the end of Democratic rule that had lasted 40 years. It was even worse for the Democrats under Barack Obama, an astounding 63-seat loss in 2010. So what's going to happen in November? President Trump has a Republican House and Senate. It's going to be difficult, not impossible, but difficult for the Democrats to win a majority in the Senate, considering that of the 34 seats up this year, 26 of them are held by the Democrats, only 8 by the Republicans. The Dems have far more seats to defend. But what about the House? Republicans currently have a 241 to 194 advantage. Democrats need a net gain of 24 seats to win a majority. The conventional wisdom had long been that the GOP's dominance in redistricting, drawing safe seats for its members, was enough to keep Paul Ryan as Speaker. But we've been seeing a steady flow of Republicans heading for the exits, a sign that some may be envisioning an anti-Trump surge this fall. Nathan Gonzalez is editor and publisher of Inside Elections, a highly respected newsletter that analyzes Senate, House, gubernatorial, and presidential elections. He is especially knowledgeable of House races. Nathan, it's great having you on The Political Junkie.
Ken, with you, it's a privilege.
Well, thank you for saying that, and I feel exactly the same. You know, as I said in the intro, there was once a time when the feeling was Republican control of the House was safe, you know, or at least until the new census is taken in 2020. Is that still the case?
The short answer is no. I think, you know, history tells us that midterm elections are terrible for the president's party. So actually the best way or the quickest way for Democrats to regain the House was actually to lose the 2016 presidential race, because now you have a midterm election with a Republican president in the Oval Office. You know, I went back and looked. The president's party has lost House seats in 18 of the last 20 midterm elections. The average seat loss in those 18 midterms is 33 seats. Now, as you said, Democrats need a net gain of 24, so history's on their side. One of the things that causes me to pause, though, is that those historical trends are based on kind of a fundamental aspect of midterms, and that's if voters don't like the job the president is doing, they can't vote against the president because he's not on the ballot. But there's this odd, I think, disconnect between President Trump and the Republican Party. I think a lot of voters, particularly independents, don't automatically view President Trump as the leader of the Republican Party. He's kind of his own entity, his own brand. So if they don't like what he's doing, it's not automatic that they're going to punish Republican candidates. Democrats are going to make that case over the next 10 months, but it just, you know, the history's there, but I'm not convinced it's going to hold up exactly like what we've seen in the past.
But you can make the case, or I think you can make the case, that for the most part, when Republicans in the House respond to President Trump's directives or initiatives or wishes, they seem to be almost, in many cases, lockstep. I mean, there are some outliers, of course, the Charlie Dents of the world, the Pennsylvania Republican who's retiring. But for the most part, I mean, I think the reason I'm saying that is because as always, I always go back to 1974 and the Watergate year. And there were a lot of Republicans who did not break into the Watergate office building. And there were a lot of them who were not especially close with Nixon. But a lot of them paid the price in November. And I still think, and you make the case, that's true, that Trump is not a conventional Republican. But as you say, the Democrats will try to make the case that they all should be linked together.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, and I don't want to downplay, I mean, Democrats have a tremendous opportunity. I think when we're talking about November, we're talking about the difference between Democrats having a good year and a historic year in terms of the election cycle, because President Trump, he's doing at least one thing well, and that's energizing the Democratic Party. We know that from the specials in 2017 and here in early 2018. And President Trump casts this uncertainty about in the Republican side. And what I mean is that I think the Republican Party is divided in about three ways right now. There are Republicans who are loyal to President Trump. There are those that are loyal to, I would say, the Republican Party, and those that are loyal to a conservative ideology. And that makes it complicated to actually get things done on the Hill. But it also has the potential to be a problem for Republican turnout in November, because if those voters that are loyal to President Trump, if they don't believe that Republicans on the Hill are doing enough to support the president and his agenda, then why would they turn out in the election? And if Republican turnout is down, then that could create huge losses on the Republican side.
You mentioned earlier that Donald Trump is doing a great job of uniting the Democrats, probably more so than Nancy Pelosi, I guess. But what role do you think that Trump plays in November? Does he go out and campaign? We saw in the Alabama special Senate race that his influence wasn't really much to talk about.
Yeah, and I think Alabama, I mean, it was a historic victory. I mean, having a Democrat representing Alabama in this day and age is huge. But there is that big asterisk where you have an alleged pedophile as Republicans nominee. I'm not sure anybody could have pulled Roy Moore out of that race. And I talked to a Democratic strategist yesterday. When you take all that under consideration, the Democrats still won by, I think, a point and a half. So what's the President Trump factor here? I think he can help the party with raising money. The RNC fundraising has been good, and that could help translate into get-out-the-vote operations in the states. That's really what the role the RNC and DNC plays in a midterm is helping fund some of those ground operations. Where does he go? I think if he goes to some of those states where he won big, where there are top Senate races, such as West Virginia or North Dakota, Indiana, Missouri, you know, I don't think I'd want to be the Democratic senator running for re-election there if the president is coming in and opposing me. But there's also, in my mind, you just don't know with President Trump, right, what he's going to do. And if he doesn't get his way on the Hill with legislation, who does he blame? And what we found out last year is he would blame Republicans before he would even blame Democrats. And so he has this ability. He could boost turnout, or he could suppress turnout, depending on where he aims his blame when things don't go his way.
And when you talked about the Democratic enthusiasm, I think whenever Democrats talk about impeachment, and as unlikely as that seems at the moment, it's certainly impossible to envision impeachment with Republican control of Congress. So if nothing else, Democrats are saying how important the vote is in November, because if you want to impeach the president, you have to have Democrats in charge of at least one chamber.
You're right, and that's Democrats are, there's already a little bit of division. I mean, there's division on the Democratic side in multiple ways, but division on how much to talk about impeachment even now, and if they get the majority, then that's only going to be ratcheted up, and there'll be some Democrats who say, absolutely, we have to hold him accountable, and then another side can say, well, look, let's not go as far as what Republicans did against President Bill Clinton and the backlash that happened there.
In the 98 midterms.
Right, correct. I mean, a midterm, again, where the president is supposed to lose seats, but Republicans overplayed their hand. So I hate it. You know, there are some voters who say, well, what's the difference? Who cares who's in the majority? They're all the same. They're all corrupt. But there's a significant difference between the Republicans and in the majority and Democrats in the majority, and whether it's holding committees and controlling what legislation comes to the floor, but also who controls investigations. It would be a completely different Washington if Democrats were in charge.
When we're talking about what some of the weak spots for Republicans or trouble signs ahead, certainly you have to mention all these retirements, these Republican retirements, these Republican House members who have recently announced they're leaving.
Right. You know, and this week, we're just adding to those numbers. Your listeners are more attuned than the rest. I think the word retirement is used too loosely, because I don't count members who are trying to run for the Senate or even trying to run for governor. I don't think they're really retiring. They're leaving the House, but we're still, there are more members now. We passed the average. I went back over the last 40 years, and the average number of members retiring, not seeking another office, is 22. We're at 28 right now. That's between Republicans and Democrats, but there are more Republicans. I think we're at 21 Republicans and 7 Democrats now not seeking reelection and not seeking another office. So I think there's a difference in retiring and running for something else. But the bottom line is the open seats when we're talking about the control. And it ranges. I think the open seats in South Florida, where Ileana Ross-Layton is not running, or Dave Reichert in Washington's 8th District, you know, that's a big difference than Trey Gowdy not seeking re-election in a seat that the Republican presidential candidate has received 60% in the last 3 races.
And you mentioned, when you mentioned Ross-Layton and you mentioned Reichert in Washington State, they're among the 2 of the 23 Republicans who represent districts won by Hillary Clinton. So you have Ed Royce and Daryl Issa in California. Both are retiring. Of course, Martha McSally is running for the Senate, so she's leaving. Pat Meehan in Pennsylvania in some kind of a mini scandal there. But they're all leaving. And given the fact that Hillary Clinton took the district, those districts, Democrats have to feel enthused at the minimum for those seats.
Right. I mean, those were already takeover targets. I mean, maybe not Ross-Layton, but those Orange County seats in California, I mean, those are, and now that they're open, they've got to be top opportunities.
You also have people like Rodney Frelinghuysen in New Jersey, who not only has been a Democratic target, but conservatives have never loved him either. And you have a bunch of Republicans, you know, the Charlie Dents of Pennsylvania I mentioned early. They seem to be squeezed out by the party moving further to the right, while the Democrats seem to be more emboldened. And these so-called moderate Republicans, there are fewer and fewer of them.
Right. I mean, I think Charlie Dent he's very vocal on his exit and his frustration towards some of his colleagues, particularly those in the House Freedom Caucus. Yeah, you know, Ken, I think that Democrats, I mean, Republicans have been fighting amongst themselves for at least 9 years now. You're starting to see it, though, on the Democratic side. I think Democrats are only maybe 2 cycles behind on the party infighting, and I think we saw that with Bernie Sanders' candidacy against Hillary Clinton. I think we're starting to see it in some of these congressional primaries, particularly in open seats and some challenger races, where, you know, there's no leader of the Democratic Party right now, and everyone thinks they know the right ideology and the right strategy to get out, and there's going to be a push to the left. In a weird way, I think some of the progressive and liberal activists look at the Tea Party with admiration, because they've seen what the Tea Party has been able to do to the Republican Party by not compromising and not giving in and kind of pull the entire party to the right. And I think that might be a blueprint for some groups on the left.
I know it's only the end of January, the beginning of February, but early bird prediction, what party takes the House? From Nathan Gonzalez?
Yeah, but mark it down.
Exactly.
And tweet angrily at me later. I'm not one of these people that, after 2016, just throws all of history out. I think there is something for these trends, and I think Democrats are going to do well. I would say that they have a better than 50-50 shot. I don't put it in specific percentages, but I just think there's a lot going for them. The thing that we're waiting right now in this point in the cycle, that I'm waiting, I can't speak for everyone, to see is, do those national numbers, the president's job rating, the national generic ballot, what does it look like in the seats, the competitive seats? Are Republicans struggling in the competitive seats? I don't care, the president's unpopular in Los Angeles, but, you know, what is the impact in Orange County and what is its impact on the Republican candidates. So I think we need that state-specific, district-specific data to really have a clear idea of what's going on.
Nathan Gonzalez is an expert political analyst and the editor and publisher of Inside Elections. Nathan, it was great having you on the program.
No problem. Thank you, Ken.
Our house here has a crown. There's always something happening, and it's usually quite loud. Our mum, she's so house proud. Nothing ever slows her down, and a mess is not allowed.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, in light of Sunday's Super Bowl between two East Coast teams, when was the last presidential election that featured two major party nominees who were born on the East Coast? The answer, 2000, when George W. Bush, born in New Haven, Connecticut, not Texas, defeated Al Gore, born in Washington, D.C., not Tennessee. And the randomly selected winner is Sandra Anderson of Champlin, Minnesota. Sandra wins the coveted political junkie button. And we have a scuttle button winner as well. That's that waste of time contest where you need to take a word or concept from each button I post and then come up with a familiar saying or slogan. The last contest led off with an I'm a Bruno fan button for the 1960s wrestling champion Bruno Sammartino. Then came a Tom Fink for governor button from Alaska, the omnipresent Jennings for governor UFTA slogan from Minnesota, and finally an Oprah Winfrey for president button. So when you combine fan, Tom, UFTA, Oprah, you kind of get Phantom of the Opera. I think you get that. It's a novel first published in 1909 and one that led to popular stage performances with music by Andrew Lloyd Webber. But I will always think of that 1925 silent movie back when I was just a kid that starred Lon Chaney. It left an indelible imprint in my memory. Here is my favorite scene from that movie. Anyway, the Scuttlebutton winner is Philip Dewar of Needham, Massachusetts. We'll have a new Scuttlebutton puzzle up on our website this weekend. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all at krpoliticaljunkie.com.
And though you turn from me to glance behind,
in many of the 213 episodes you've heard on The Political Junkie, there has been no shortage of journalists and authors talking about their favorite campaign stories. We haven't heard much from political consultants, but there's a new book out by longtime Ohio Democratic consultant Jerry Austin that's filled with fun and memorable tales from the campaign trail. It's called True Tales from the Campaign Trail, stories only political consultants can tell. Jerry was Jesse Jackson's campaign manager in 1988 and helped elect Richard Celeste governor of Ohio in 1982. He also worked for many other candidates, including John Glenn. And he's here, hopefully, to share some of his favorite stories. Jerry Austin, welcome back to The Political Junkie.
Great to be back.
Well, you know, a lot of the political stories in the book are fun. And as I start to say that, I realize that it's not many people who are using the word fun and politics anymore. Is politics fun anymore?
I don't think so. I'm retired now, and one of the reasons is that it isn't fun anymore. These stories reflect the time when Democrats and Republicans were adversaries, but they never were enemies. That's not true today.
You had a lot of fun stories about Jackson from the 88 campaign in your book. What's your favorite?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that he and I did not know each other. And when I was recruited, I called his campaign manager from 1984, who I knew, a guy named Arnold Pinckney. And I said, what do you think? Can we get along? And he said, well, if both of you leave your egos at the door, you probably can get along. And we did. And he came to trust me rather quickly, and I had a campaign to run. And so he said to me, what's the first thing you're going to do when you take over the campaign? I said, first of all, I want to see what the office is like. And I went into the office, and it was just like a disaster area. I mean, it was garbage all over the place, and mail stacked up, and it was dirty. And he said, so what are you going to do? I said, first of all, I'm telling everybody not to come in tomorrow morning. I'm going to have the whole place cleaned by a professional cleaning outfit. Then I'm going to tell them what the rules are. And the rules are that if the campaign office looks like this, it means the campaign looks like this, disoriented, disarray, and not functioning properly. So I want an office to look like a campaign. He said, hey, what are you going to do about the mail? I said, I'll take care of the mail. And I got 12,000 stamps to take care of the mail. Don't ask me how I got them. But the thing about him was that a lot of people, I don't know, for some reason, don't think he's very smart. And I watched him when the first meetings I attended with him on Wall Street at McDonald's company, where he was talking to a bunch of vice presidents, and he blew them away. I mean, he wasn't talking economics 101. I mean, he's very smart, very articulate. He's the hardest working candidate I've ever been around. I woke him up at 6:30 and put him to bed at 1:30. You know, he didn't require a lot because he didn't eat anything but fried food. So we'd have fried chicken, and then once in a while we'd have fried fish. And of course, the reporters on the plane got sick and tired of that. So I had to go get salads and stuff like that. But it was an adventure, and it was hard work, and we won a lot, and we lost a lot. But, it was fun. It was fun.
Well, there was one story in the book which really made me laugh. Something like you went on TV representing Jackson, and you called the New York City Mayor Ed Koch, who basically really disliked Jackson. You called Koch an idiot, and Jackson was not too pleased with that, was he?
No, but the funniest thing was that when he confronted me about it, he said, I understand that you called Ed Koch a moron. I said, no, I never called him a moron. He said, I'm told you called him a moron. I said, no, I called him an idiot. And he said, well, you can't do that. I said, no, I can do that. You can't do that. I also said during that same New York primary when it was over and Jackson came in second to Dukakis, but he won the city, that Al Gore, who was supported by Koch, came to New York to get bar mitzvahed, and he wound up getting circumcised.
Oh, no.
But it was in the New York Post, as you wouldn't be surprised.
That's a great line. You know, there was also one story that I remember really liking. The idea was, I think, using a candidate's fault to his benefit. I think his name is Tom Hsieh. He's a Chinese immigrant who ran for mayor of San Francisco in 1981. But as you described it, he had this problem of failing to use verbs when he spoke. So you instructed him what to say about the incumbent Art Agnos. The story is hysterical. Please tell us that story.
Well, the year actually was 1991, and he was the first Chinese-born American citizen to run for mayor of a major city. His name is Tom Hsieh, H-S-I-E-H, and he spoke like the Cookie Monster, without verbs. And one of the premier happenings in any San Francisco race is that there's a debate, usually the Thursday before the election, from 7:30 to 9 o'clock at night, live on, one of the major networks. And this was preparing him for this debate. And each candidate got, maybe a minute 30 to say whatever they wanted to say. So I had him practice with verbs saying that Art Agnos, who is the incumbent mayor, that Agnos's homeless program was a pipe dream. And we kept practicing and practicing. Anyway, the show begins, and it comes to the point where candidate Hsieh was to offer, his comment. And he looked in the camera and he said, Agnos homeless program, wet dream.
Not pipe dream.
Everybody the laughter was unbelievable. And sitting next to me was Dee Dee Meyer, who, as you know, wound up becoming Bill Clinton's press secretary. She's on the floor laughing. And when the show was over, he came over and said, why are they laughing at me? I said, Tom, you were supposed to say it was a pipe dream. You said it was a wet dream. And he said, well, what's the difference?
Well, you had another story that this absolutely cracked me up. Ted Kennedy opened up a campaign headquarters in Florida for the caucuses in, I guess, 1979, and they found what they thought was a perfect place to set up shop in West Palm Beach. And then this National Enquirer photographer kept coming around taking pictures, and nobody could understand why. Tell us why the photographer was taking these pictures.
The story is from a consultant by the name of Doc Schweitzer out of Philadelphia. And when he told me the story, I was there. I was actually in West Palm Beach and remembered that. And I actually had a picture, that picture that's described in the story. But what happened was that Doc was a young 22-year-old, came down to open up
a headquarters for Kennedy in Palm Beach County, Boundless headquarters, and had this opening and never realized that above the headquarters was a billboard or a sign, I guess. I guess it was a sign from a previous owner that said, learn to drive. So here he has a Kennedy headquarters, you know, after Chappaquiddick would learn to drive, and he was devastated by it, and you know, thought his career was ended, but he's still going strong, so he survived.
So basically, you have a sign. I mean, this was a former driving studio, so you have a sign. The top of the sign is learn to drive, and then under that was Ted Kennedy. That was that had to be amazing.
Well, and the amazing story is I had seen it, the story in the paper. I mean, I was down there, because I was working for Carter at the time. And when Doc was telling me the story, I mean, I said, how could you not know, see this sign? I said, I can't tell you how I didn't know, but I didn't. And obviously, if I would have known, I wouldn't have taken that spot, but I did. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a story.
That's true. Well, is there a favorite story in the book? I mean, there were so many, and I should point out that in the book, first of all the stories are not from you, and they're also from Republicans as well as Democrats. So it was really a hodgepodge of just great stories over the years. But do you have a favorite?
Let me give you a story from that's going to be in book two.
Okay.
So this is what happens when I interview people, and I get a story I'm not expecting. I interviewed a Republican whose name is Sal Russo, and Sal's out in Sacramento. And basically, the story involves Ronald Reagan's communications director, Mike Deaver. Mike Deaver's in the White House with Reagan. Sal had worked for Reagan when he was governor. He was like his body guy. But Sal is the chief of staff to George Duke Majan in California. And Deaver calls him and said, I need your help. Queen Elizabeth is coming to the United States, and she's coming to address the joint session of the California legislature, and we want you to be our point guy. He says, great, anything you want. So Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip come out to Sacramento, and they come to the governor's office, and they put him in a holding room, and Diva's there, and Sal's there, and the governor's there. And all of a sudden, as Sal describes, a lady-in-waiting came out of their holding room and came over and said, Mom would like a gin and tonic. And the governor said, what did she say? He said, she wants a gin and tonic. Queen wants a gin and tonic. And the governor said, we don't have any booze here in the state house. And Sal said, but Governor, just move over a second. He opened up a desk, and it was a full bar in this desk that the governor didn't even know was in his own office. And so they send in to gin and tonics. 20 minutes go by, and lady-in-waiting comes back again. Mom would like the whole bottle. And Sal says, I can't, this is rot-gut gin. I can't send in rot-gut gin. And Diva says, she won't know the difference. She'll pick some exquisite California brand. So they send it in. And when they left, they finished the whole bottle. It basically was the end of the story. But a week later of him telling this story, New York Times has a big article about the Queen's drinking habits. That she had at four different times during the day, two drinks. She had eight drinks a day. And I called Sal and said, you know, you saw this before anybody else did, you know, almost 40 years ago. But when I sat down with him, and Sal's been a longtime political consultant for the Republicans, I wasn't expecting to get a story about Queen Elizabeth.
Jerry Austin is a retired Democratic consultant from Ohio and author of the new book, True Tales from the Campaign Trail, a compilation of fun and personal stories from Democratic and Republican consultants alike. It's a fun read, and Jerry, it's my understanding that Volume 2 will be even funner. So I'm looking forward to that. Jerry, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for being on the show.
I appreciate it, and it's on Amazon.
When we're only rocking on the porch, living all our glory, you might have a few less cars, but I'll have better stories. You might have more brain cells left, but I'll have better stories.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
When we're only rocking on the